Well, hello and welcome to The Sacred Speaks. My name is John Price. I'm your host. And today I would like to introduce you to something exciting that's happening in the background. One of the reasons why I have not been as consistent on the podcast. There's been a lot happening here at the Center for Healing Arts and Sciences. Look us up at thecenterforhas.com. We've created a community called Narmadi, and I'd like to read a bit of a description, and then we'll get to the participant today. So Narmadi is a sanctuary for exploration, connection, and personal transformation. It's where you can dive deep into your spiritual journey, supported by a vibrant community of seekers and healers just like you. We're breaking new ground by integrating the biopsychosocial spiritual model, ensuring your being, your entire being, is being nurtured. Whether you're spiritual but not religious, or simply seeking deeper meaning and connection, Narmadi offers a non-dogmatic space to explore, grow, and heal. Join us for daily inspirations, weekly deep dives, a plethora of enriching events designed to empower your journey toward a more authentic, compassionate, and interconnected existence. And we'll embark on it together. The Sacred Speaks is going to be a massive aspect of Narmadi. We'll be using all the participants that have come along. There's going to be a weekly discussion group and many other elements that you can go check out by looking up Narmadi. So follow the link below and check out our community and welcome. So other updates, of course, check the center out, check out Narmadi, check out The Sacred Speaks, thesacredspeaks.com. As always, the Jung Center Houston, younghouston.org, and Modern Nations as the music. Always hang out to the end of the episode and you can listen to the song Clouds, which has been the theme music since the very beginning. So thank you for that. And so to Dimitri Muganis. I want to read his bio real quick and then get started. Dimitri Muganis, harm reduction advocate and psychedelic practitioner, musician, writer, and community organizer, became the face of using underground ibogaine to kick heroin addiction in the United States. He developed a hybrid modality of administration that integrates the ceremonial and musical elements of traditional ibogaine ceremonies with the safest protocols of Western medicine. His story is the focus of a documentary, I'm Dangerous with Love, and his work has been documented by the New York Times, Rolling Stone, This American Life, HBO, and many more. Even though ibogaine is still prohibited in the U.S., it is attracting avid interest from researchers all over the world and becoming accepted amongst care providers and clinics. Dimitri has led over 500 ibogaine ceremonies and supported numerous individuals with their problematic habits. He's also performed thousands of ceremonies using sound, art, and psychedelics, especially psilocybin and MDMA, to help individuals break with their psychological suffering and to spark spiritual awakenings. Immersed in the psychedelic space for the last 20 years, Muganis is an expert in both the potential and limitations of psychedelic medicines. A respected icon in the field of harm reduction, he co-created a holistic program at the New York Harm Reduction Educators, a groundbreaking Harlem-based community organization bringing together acupuncture rituals, sound meditation, Reiki, body work, and other treatment modalities for people experiencing homelessness, active drug use, sex workers, and formerly incarcerated. Check him out at cardea.net. This is cool. The next episode I've got it is Ross Ellenhorn. They're both partnered on this cool community. And Cardea is a fantastic community. It's like an arts community that does experiential work in New York. Check them out at cardea.net. And for now, I think that's it. You'll hear a lot from Dimitri. You'll hear a lot from Ross. And for now, we'll leave it there. Thanks for being here. Man, Dimitri, it's really good to connect. We were kind of course, connecting on the fact that my research involved reading Village Voice articles, reading the Rolling Stone, watching your old YouTube stuff, listening to your band. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that great rabbit trails, a lot of chaos, you know, a lot of wildness and a lot of beauty and love. And it was a great ride, man. I'm eager, as you know, I have an affection for your how you show up in the world. I was telling our mutual connection, Ross, that earlier. So I'm eager to dive in. I want to get into your story. I've organized our conversation in a couple of ways. We get to go wherever the spirit moves us. But if you're cool to just dive in, you mind if we launch?
Yeah, Let's go, man. Let's go.
Great, yeah. Man. Thank you. So, of course, This American Life, which I'll have a link below to the, it's about a 16-minute, amazing 16 minutes that goes into your life, talking about what I meant earlier in this kind of wildness. And would you talk about your background and, of course, noting the transformation personally, because we want to certainly connect with psychedelics and modern medicalization of addiction treatment and so on and so forth. So just start with you.
Okay, well, I guess the reason you're talking to me is, I know the reason you're talking to me is because my association with psychedelics, and I like to say that, I'll start it this way. I'm from Detroit, Greek-American. I'm born in 1962. I grew up in that epoch of the 60s and 70s in Detroit, which was a changing city as the country changed. It went from the arsenal of democracy to murder capital. Mm-hmm. There was drugs everywhere. There's also art. There's also music. There was also radical politics in my family. I was also diagnosed early on. I mean, I wasn't even diagnosed. I was put in the dumb class. We'll say it that way. Mm-hmm. And eventually they said I had learning disabilities. And then they said I was dyslexic. Yeah. And I, at this point, I reject it all. I found the term that describes what I am, which is functionally illiterate. And therefore, mm-hmm. there's no diagnosis. It's just a description. And if you look that up, you'll find out what I'm talking about. So, but being functionally illiterate meant that I was diagnosed. I was put aside. And I had a difficult time at school. There's some difficult issues around my family, and I had a couple of traumatic events like we all do as children, and maybe harder, maybe not, I don't know. But what I found inspiration in music and art and politics, and some of the people around that music and art and politics were also people who used drugs. They were some of my heroes. There was a lot of drug use as a kid growing up in the city, Detroit. And I was drawn to drugs. I was drawn to drugs both as a way to as a balm, as a salve for pain, and then also as a way of exploring and opening. And so I was very attracted to altered states. I was the kid that when they used to do that, I guess it's breath work, right? We would just breathe real hard, and then the bigger kid would squeeze your stomach, yeah. And you would lay down, and you'd go into a different world. I'd line up to do it immediately again and again and again. And so I started using drugs. I got two older brothers, and started using drugs at a very early age. Started getting high and drinking maybe at 11, and then I started playing music at 14 and interested in theater, and getting worse and worse in school and more chaotic at my home and on the street. And eventually I found a home in opiate use. And I had a over 20-year relationship habit with heroin and cocaine, intravenous and methadone, and a lot of other drugs. In that time, I it's a long story, but I left Detroit. I left Detroit, came to New York, pursued my dream of becoming a musician, but met and spent time with my heroes and became dear friends with Herbert Hunke and Gregory Corso and other people that were my heroes as a kid. And my world did expand because of drugs and because of art and because of the people I met. And what happened, though, there was a point where it began to contract, and the death started to mount. And it was the days of HIV/AIDS, and I was at the epicenter of that in the 80s on the Lower East Side. And so I lost people to that, lost people to overdose, lost people to murder, lost people to the prison industrial complex. And I began to be more and more lost. I was consuming towards the end of that 20-year run. And I got to say, there was some really great years in there. But towards the end of that 20-year run, I was experiencing, I guess for like 10 years of that 20-year run, I was experiencing psychosis from injecting cocaine. And eventually, more and more people died. I ended up back in Detroit, back in my parents' basement. My common-law wife had died while pregnant from endocarditis related to injecting. I was ready to die. My first thoughts in the morning was death, and my last thoughts in the evening was death. And I lived for the drugs, and I was turning 40, and I didn't really see a way out. Like I said, I'm Greek American, and I was really longing to go to Greece. Like one time before I died, but there was no way to do that. Those of us who have had habitual opioid use or habits or addiction know the difficulties in just doing simple things like traveling. I couldn't go to Greece, and Greek Americans go all the time. So I was watching family and friends go, and I hadn't been since I was a kid. I had heard about ibogaine, sort of in the artistic and political circles of I guess early 90s, not the 80s, the early 90s. I heard from a guy named Adam Nodelman, who was a pretty well-known noise musician. He played in several bands, including Missing Foundation and other bands. But he was my buddy, and he was telling me about this thing called ibogaine while we were all injecting, and that he had done it, and that he had broke his habit. I think it's telling to say that we were injecting. So he had gone and broke his habit, but came back. But that's the first time I heard about it. And then it wasn't until almost 10 years later, maybe 2021, no, 2001, or yeah, I think that's one or two, when I was near my end, and I thought I'd like to go to Greece, and maybe I could just take this thing, go to Greece, and then come home and die, because my life was, that's where I was with it. I wanted to die. And so after a lot of, some searching, we ended up reaching out to Dana Beale, who the former Yippie leader and madman and extraordinaire, dear friend of mine. Dana hooked us up with some people in the underground, and then people in the underground hooked us up with somebody in Holland, since I was going to Holland, which was Sarah Glatt. And I went to Sarah's house just outside of Amsterdam. My family scraped together the money. I think back then it was like 1800 bucks, which was a lot of money for my family at the time. My brother got in the plane with me because he said, "Wait a minute, we're giving you 1800 bucks to go to Amsterdam to kick heroin," especially at the time, Amsterdam. I see John's laughing because he knows that there was a legend. Amsterdam was the legend of, it was Mecca for junkies, but he came with me. And I did Iboga. I didn't do ibogaine at first. I did Iboga, and Sarah is this hippie lady, like constantly smoking weed with six kids, and this home, and this sort of hippie home in the field where there was a fucking windmill there. And I hadn't traveled as an adult, and I'm there, and I was drunk on the plane when I got there. I showed up, there's this family, really, the sort of hippie family, and I did the iboga there. But one interesting thing was but it was part of the iboga coincidence, and there's other stories I could tell, but people who've worked in iboga know this so-called coincidence. I was just about to consume it, and I said, "Sarah, I've heard about you from my friend Adam, but I haven't seen him in 5 years." Adam, the first guy to tell me about iboga. And she said, "Well, Adam will be here in 3 days." So I reunited with my dear friend. Unfortunately, Adam succumbed, and he passed away from an overdose. But I went and I did the process, and it was an ass kicking, for sure. I didn't have a desire to use the entire time. 3 days of vomiting and visions and pain, but it wasn't the pain of withdrawal, it was the pain of iboga, I guess. And I resolved so much. Well, I thought I resolved so much. I began to resolve a lot, which I'm still
Started
in
a
the
process,
process of.
yeah.
But the miracle was, and I can talk about visions and all of that, but it was tough, 3.5 days. The miracle was that I came awake. I didn't really sleep for 3 days because I had to keep taking more iboga And these days they wouldn't even detox you on methadone. I mean, this was like no medical, nothing. It was just me. You know, for those who ever detox from methadone know how hard it is, but I came out of it. And although it was painful, I had no desire. There was never a point for me anyways. And this is not true for a lot of people. I should say that a lot of people want to use in the process, but I had no desire to use. I had some money because I was going to Greece right afterwards, and I had no desire to use. And I came out of that, and I was exhausted, beat up. I was 39 years old. I had 8 days to recover, and I was just. I can't ask for another 10 days like that, because it was enough. It was enough for one lifetime, because it delivered me from physical dependency, but it also, I forgave myself for my wife's death. That stayed, my forgiveness for my wife's death. I knew that wasn't my fault. I actually began to explore some childhood sexual trauma, and to be able to look at some other habitual patterns, which I'm still unpacking now. But I remember just sitting there weeping, and 3 days later saying, praise God. And one of the young girls, one of the daughters, she may be about 10 years old, real sassy, smart, great little girl, came up and said, you know, and it was a black man from the place called the Bronx who was saying the same thing just a few days ago. So, you know, I was in that space, and wherever that brother is now, I hope he's well, because I was in that space next. And, you know, and the other thing is I saw a bunch of stuff that's hard to explain. And just, you mentioned This American Life, just to give you an idea of what I saw my trip to Gabon. I saw that I would be doing these types of things that we're doing now, but I actually saw that I would be on This American Life. So crazy. And I saw my teachers in Gabon, a bunch of other crazy shit, but just on the science piece of it, like I was a junkie, and then I wasn't, I didn't have a desire to use. And then Adam came, and we ran around Amsterdam, and I didn't have a desire to use. And then 3 months in Greece afterwards, which I think was as equal or if not more important in my recovery than anything. But I spent three months in the village in Greece, which is a whole other story, or a part of the story.
A lot there, man. Yeah, I'm feeling that on all kinds of levels. But you started off talking about the reason why I want to chat with you, which are many. There's several different levels, and I want to clearly define those. You're going into them, certainly. It's from psychedelics, but really it's alternate states of consciousness. And I want to talk about that as a process and connect it with religion and healing. Because when I look at you and what you've been doing in your life, I'm really watching this. One thing that I find so attractive about you and your approach is the wildness. I mean, there's not the clinical dimension. There's an experiential and a relational dimension. And you're involved in so many healing endeavors that I think it's important to explore that and try to figure out what it is that has kept you going. So when I say that, alternate states of consciousness, religion, healing, what comes up?
Well, I say this, and I don't want to go to sort of path sayings that I use, but I always say my first plant teachers were coca and poppy. Mm-hmm. That breath work I was doing as a 9 and 10 year old, I was pursuing something, was pursuing an altered state of consciousness. And then what else comes up is religion, because, you know, I was raised by sort of leftist, at least my father, leftist atheist. But there was my grandmother's and the influence, although I didn't have the experience of a lot of people growing up in the church. There was Jesus. and you know, for me, as an active drug user, and I think this is true in the States and maybe not so true in Europe, as I talk to people who work with drug users in Europe, and I think there are a lot of reasons for that. And at least the folks I worked with, these are, like, for instance, in the harm reduction space, most people coming in are theists. And a lot of the people running the joint are atheists, you know, or agnostic. But for me, I, you know, there's no atheist in a foxhole. I've abbreviated that to say there's no atheist in the K-hole. Mm-hmm. The experience of fellow drug users, my experience with them and working with them is these are very spiritual people. These are people in the pursuit of God, in the pursuit of holiness, in the pursuit of almost a monastic aesthetic, pain and release, deprivation and release, deprivation. It's almost like that type of lifestyle. It's almost, and so I think that like my whole life in art and in drugs and in trying to be of service was somehow connected with God. And I don't think religion necessarily is a dirty thing. I think real estate is dirty. And I think people confuse the pursuit of real estate with the somehow confusing it with religion. I don't know. I like the question. Yeah. It's also good to talk to a shrink and like, I don't have to pay you, bro.
We'll dive awesome. In and it's tell awesome. Me, it's tell awesome. Me about your history. Well, that's where we're going, but there's a, so if we broaden that, cause I'm, you start talking about this and I start getting curious about your connections to African religious tradition and what the nature of your process was like there. Cause you mentioned at one point you have a spiritual father and a teacher, and I'm curious about that process of initiation. I'm curious about when you come back here and look at the modern, we would even say kind of medicalized treatment process, what your critiques are. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Take that.
You know, what happened was I began just to bring folks sort of up to it. Part of the thing that happened to me, the Iboga, was that I saw that which happens with a lot of folks, and it just happens with a lot of folks that have a life-changing experience, especially people who have nothing, who have no mortgage, who have no job, who have no car payment, who have no children, who have no responsibilities, as I did, that they're looking for something. Now, I have always an artist and activist at some level, but it's been years. So the idea to be of service is natural, especially coming into it with the zeal of the newly converted. I just sort of threw myself in to I was Saul, I was Paul after Saul, right? I had to let the world know. And so I did this whole thing of radical service. I learned as I went and did sort of in a secular way. And then eventually, there's a whole series of things that happened that started at a peyote ceremony, my first ceremony ever, where the roadman gave me an object and said, use this in your ceremony, because I was detoxing people very publicly in New York City. I was on fucking This American Life, right? I mean, at the time, like 20 years ago, that was a big, big show, right?
Of course.
Anyway, eventually I found myself in Gabon, where Iboga is found, and where a spiritual tradition called Bwiti has grown up around its ingestion. And for me, at the time, it was placing everything together. What I saw in Gabon was, when I got there, there was this drug, and forgive me, because the Bwiti, people who are Bwitis listening to this, I don't use it in the pejorative term in French, which is the colonial language there. I think it has a more negative connotation than it does here, but it's a drug. And it is a sacrament, mm-hmm. and it is a medicine. It is a sacrament to the people in Bliti, and there's many different ways of practicing Bliti depending on ethnicity and the village you're in. And I don't pretend to be an expert on Bliti at all. But I went there to be initiated, to learn more. This was after I was working with Ibogaine for several years. I think I was the first Ibogaine provider to be initiated. This must have been 18 years ago, maybe more, year or more or less, I don't know. But what I saw there was that there was this drug, the central sacrament, much like ayahuasca or peyote or chuma or whatever. Mm. And then there was this technology of art, the performing arts, song, and in this case, dance, that was the performing art as healing art. And then much like those other drug sacraments in other parts of the world, the pharmacopoeia of the surrounding area, which, you know, the first being iboga, but all the other plants and all the knowledge of all the other plants. And what I saw just in a real simplistic way, or simplistic but profound for me, was there was drugs, sacrament, dance, community, and this music that was somehow directly related to the music that saved my life. Lou Reed said his life was saved by rock and roll. My life was saved by rock and roll. My life was saved by jazz. My life was saved by art. My life was saved by culture. So there was this incredible music that reminded me of house because of the repetitive nature of it. It would go on. And I could hear the blues. I could hear modern jazz. I could hear all the stuff because it comes from there, right? And then this beautiful sort of dancing around the person in the middle, right? And sort of the elevation, which really reminded me of house, the house scenes, or even any music ethos, punk scene in the early days when I was a kid. There was a community, there was a family. So what I saw there, that these folks were creating space. And what interests me more than the drugs or the medicine or the psychedelic, and I do love drugs, what interests me more is the creation of space, something I've done all my life. I've been in a band where I created space. I've been a bartender where I created space with these drugs. I've ran after hours clubs. I've created space. I've been involved in creating spaces where people are safe injection spaces, where people are using heroin and other stuff, creating a holistic space. I created a space here at Gardea. What really interested me was the ceremony, not necessarily at the time I was deeply drawn to the specifics or my lack of understanding of the specifics of Bliti. But what eventually happened for me was actually the way one holds space, and space with sound, mm-hmm. space moving through time, the way a therapist, the way you hold space, and the way you've created the space here today between us. That's what interests me mm-hmm. the most. I am incredibly grateful to Bliti. I went into it and I brought elements of it home, and I tried to somehow replicate it and make it understandable. I have to stress that my level of Bliti was very low. I never claimed to initiate anybody. I never claimed to be a great Nima or a great Ganga. What I was doing was detoxing people. And what I tried to do initially for a few years was incorporate elements of the Bliti so folks could, that I thought were somehow could be useful for the individual. You know, going to the forest before you do a ceremony to sort of ask your ancestors and nature, you know, for clear passage. Well, that could be explained to a Westerner in certain ways. Certainly the bathing rituals were important. But what I loved about that was that I was beginning to be held in the embrace of the century old traditions, right? What I realized is that A, I'm a terrible student, and B, I'm not from Gabon. And although I was grateful for what they showed me, I eventually went back six times and spent maybe a total of over a year there altogether, maybe, I think. I'm bad with time. I was initiated in three different levels of initiation. But what eventually, and I'm so grateful because it brought me back to art, it brought me back to song, it brought me back to the healing of community. And what and I began to incorporate some of that work and what I learned there, not only in my Iboga detoxes, but my work in Harlem, in the drop-in center at NIRI, which is now On Point, which is a harm reduction center, where we started to do weekly rituals that were sort of a very plastic ritual that could change depending on who was there. Matter of fact, at one point we had a Bwiti Naganga, one of the great harp players, a guy named Bukaye, would come in and play. He was staying with me. We'd play the Bwiti harp in Harlem for months on end. We'd have that. But the idea, I'll get back to what the idea was, space was the most important thing. My cultural guru, my spiritual guru, said space is the place. And that was Sun Ra, and to create the space was the most interesting. What I found lacking for me in my practice, within any sort of any sort of tradition, because the structure, that holding structure, is so holding, it can become rigid. And so what I was seeing, the same types of issues that I have in a medical, with the medicalizing of it, the fetishizing and grounding something deeply in a culture that, does not have a plasticity built into it, although all cultures are plastic and moldable and changing. I saw some of the same issues. So what I mean is this. I should say again, I am a fetish priest in two traditions, okay? I have my pots, I have all that. And what happens with all this is I came back to my tradition, which is 2,000 years old in my case, and longer, which I don't pretend to understand, and I have plenty of problems with, which is Greek Orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. But like, if I'm going to have like a rigid way of viewing the world, with an epistemology that cannot be changed, or it might as well be my own. You know what I mean? If they're going to be homophobic and sexist and whatever and xenophobic, then it might as well be my own. But I, with my own, at least I could look past that, all that other stuff, and dismiss it and take the stuff that's still in my blood, because that's what the Bwiti was telling me. That's what my elders were telling me. That's what Papa Andre was telling me, my spiritual father, I saw in that vision. Go to your own thing. And so to go to my own thing, if I go past the Greek part of me, I'm here right now. I'm in Cardea's offices in Lower Manhattan, right? And actually, that's where my culture is based. It's based in this culture, rooted in this culture. And I'll get to what I mean by that in a second, but let's not forget that bit. But the same issue I had with being labeled as learning disabled or dumb or dyslexic or depressive or whatever the label is, or addict from a medical establishment, that medical gaze, this is what's wrong with you and this is how we're going to fix it. The medical gaze, that viewing of someone as a problem, as a health issue, I know how that felt. But I've also felt the shaman's gaze as well. That this is the series of things that's wrong with you. This is what you got to do to fix it. And both of them have non-compliance sort of built into it. That shaming non-compliance, right?
Yeah.
Like it fucked up, not because of us, because of what he did. So what I found was that I went into this thing trying to reproduce this absolute freedom I had from drugs, from cocaine and heroin. All I had to do was simply give people access, and that they would change. Now, they would come to me. This was before YouTube. I would be sort of the poster child at that point, 20 years ago, for Iboga. They would come and they were like, they found it. We're going to do an undergrad treatment. We worked for 4 days. And they had different results other than the sensation of drug use, which is, by the way, most people, 80% or more, who do ibogaine for detox are going to use again. And if we keep on, and that's the thing about like the movement is really sort of geared towards abstinence only. I mean, if you start looking at any of, at least the way, I mean, if you look deeper into the research, they actually ask other questions like quality of life. But if the way it's being sold to the press is that people will do mushrooms and stop drinking, this is an abstinence only base. It's not harm reduction.
Right.
And it's actually also, it's also bullshit. I mean, that'd be one thing if it was true. I don't believe it's true that the majority will stop. And I don't think that's the way we change. But the real issue, the real danger is someone comes, they want to replicate what happened with Dimitri. They come and take it. And then they end up using in 3 days, 6 weeks, I'm sorry, a year and a half, right? What's the message? What's the message to somebody who has seen, read about the trials for MDMA? They have pain, the DSM pain, however DSM wants to call it. But let's say they have pain around being in war and having to witness violence or having to witness kill or having to kill somebody. And after four treatments of MDMA and 18 courses of therapy, they are still sad. They are still angry. They are still confused. What are we telling people? That there's something wrong with them? Are we telling them this is, or are we trying to have people have a relationship with that suffering or a relationship with their addiction or their joys? So when people would use again, I would ask them, like, what else has happened? I called my mother. That's a big fucking deal. It might not be a public health deal, but it's a big deal. I'd like to use the Christ story when I'm talking about that. Christ healed the leper. Was it about a medical public health intervention into leprosy? Somehow we have to find whatever that trick that Christ did, we can heal it because, man, he's back with his family, he's back to work, he's not infecting anybody. No, the message is that Christ touched the untouchable and loved the unlovable. And so the best thing about psychedelics is that they're ineffective and they take a lot of space and a lot of times efficacy. Often that's a key measurement, right, of efficacy. How much time does it take? We're being told that it doesn't take much time. I disagree. It should take more time. Life, the more time that we can create, the more time we can create space and holding somebody and honoring somebody. I don't know what the end result is in terms of cessation of drug use or mental health, but I know that that's a good thing, is to hold people longer. So I say, quit asking me all these questions, man. You keep interrupting me. Sorry, well, that's bro. True. I'll say one thing. I'm here at Cardea office, like space. It's an art space. It's not a clinic. We don't want it to be a clinic, but I'd say we're medically supported, but we're not medicalized. Right. I'd say we honor the traditions of elders who have worked with psychedelics and for generations, but we're not that either. We're not from Johns Hopkins and we're not from the Amazon. We're from the dance floor. We're from the art gallery. We're from the demonstration. We're from the play. We're from the book. And that book is deeply rooted in what is good about modernity. And there's plenty good, including the discernments that we were just talking about, those identitarian discernments around sexuality and gender and the other, right? But we have this thing in modernity, which is about improvisation and play, and then we can find different ways of holding each other. Mm-hmm. And that's the main thing. If someone's coming to me for a mushroom ceremony or a ketamine, you know, our ketamine sessions last for sometimes 4 hours here, because A, we have a terrible business model, but that's born out of the idea that you don't have to go, man.
Yeah.
Like, stay, have a cup of tea or stay in your little space, whatever it takes, because the holding is where it's at. And that's what's missing. And I don't see a way to inject that holding into the existing economic system. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to use psychedelics to change the existing economic system.
Take that for a second. Thank you. Like, so let's just hear from your experience these two threads to maybe give a little context to what we're talking about. what is modern day heroin dependence treatment, and how would you treat heroin dependence?
You know, John Lennon said, as soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. So I would give all the time.
Yeah.
I would treat people well. The beautiful thing, when harm reduction is working well, and people use harm reduction like they fucking use psychedelics, or they use the word ceremony, right? It just means nothing. But when harm reduction is working well, your job as someone there is to be, you know, what is it, constant positive regard, or right? Your job is just to fucking love them. I mean, your job is to direct them to services, of course, you know, treat a wound, or get them into a treatment, or, you know, walk with them as they seek housing or whatever it is. But your main job is to be glad to see them, right? That's the main job. Smile, like, man, what's up? Right, especially for folks who are the leper, you know. So that would, and by the way, that's not to infantilize somebody. That's just to treat them like a human being. I mean, so, you know, if they're fucking up and they took your wallet, man, fuck them. You know what I mean? You know, but if they haven't, you know, like, or you know, or you've gotten over them taking your wallet or whatever. So how would I treat people? I would just. Really, harm reduction says that you need to offer people a menu of choices. And the menu should be, it should be like one of those old Greek diner menus from New York. It should be like 18 pages with pictures and like stuff like a Tom Turkey sandwich on the same thing as French toast. You know what I mean? It should just be like this, everything should be available. And then giving people time and the space in which to process shit, you know, and then holding them as safely as possible. We are in the midst of an opioid crisis, so a lot of this becomes about trying to keep people alive. So those options become smaller. But that's where I'd start with. I'd start with, you know, where harm reductionists have been, where great harm reductionist Dan Biggs coined the phrase, any positive change. And if we could celebrate any positive change, you know, and again, within, you know, some people think that harm reduction is just this permissiveness. No, man, we're treating people like adults, you know, and we're treating people like dignified human beings. So it would be a dignified process. I think it's a robbing of dignity to say that you come and do Ibogaine and you have a window of opportunity. Immediately, we're setting somebody up to walk away and rob them of that dignity. You're coming to do Ibogaine, and I don't fucking know. How about that? I don't fucking know. What should I do afterwards? Well, I got some ideas. Like, I'm coming in. What drug or medicine should I take for my PTSD? I don't fucking know. Like, let's discover that together. What do we do afterwards? Let's discover that together. And that would require a way different approach to everything. And I don't believe that you inject psychedelics into this corruption and it'll change it. It'll corrupt it. It's like kind of like the Holy Roman Empire and Christianity. Like the Christians thought, oh wow, my persecutor's coming and I'm gonna inject this Christianity into them and they're gonna become more Christian than Romans. The Romans thought, wow man, this is a really good thing that I can use this to expand my empire. And we know the end of that story, right? Yeah. The persecutor won. I mean, is the Holy Roman Empire more Christ-like or is Christianity become more Roman?
Yeah, well said. I was thinking about this, how you treat people, you know, just relational. And I had a thought at some point about, you mentioned opioid crisis and, you know, you've done some traveling and I'm curious about drug dependence in the West as how it differentiates from other cultures and what might be going on in our culture that is fueling some of this crisis. And also as a clinician, not to double up here, but as a clinician, I always think it's significant what somebody's drug of choice is, not because I'm trying to make them stop it, because it tells me a lot about how they live their life and some of their assumptions from a physiological, psychological, spiritual perspective. So talk a little bit about opioids in our culture and just Western dependence.
Yeah, man. It's fascinating. I mean, and I you know, I'm just a drug head nerd, you know, I've been in harm reduction in this world, so I'm always interested in who's doing what drugs, what population, you know, what young people are doing, what old people are doing, what, you know, black people are doing or white people or what ethnic groups are doing. I find it interesting. And so if you break it down, class and race, my understanding is that a lot of white working class men are taking opiates. I think alcohol for working class and poor black and brown people, depending on where they are, is more prevalent for the younger people. And also, you know, I mean, I hate to say it, man, but the weed they're smoking now is fucking, you know, the weed that the young people are, well, everyone is smoking now, some crazy shit, I think. Mm-hmm. But anyways, it's a whole other thing. And so, you know, the question is why? You know, why is this happening? And this is my problem with, you know, initiatives. I should say this, that Ibogaine and other psychedelics have been used, have been sold as a way to combat public disruption, that somehow we will give mushrooms and like we won't have the problems we have in Portland, or you know, there's an initiative to spend a bunch of working people's money on psychedelic research out of the Sackler Fund from Kentucky, which I think is criminal to take that money from working people and poor people who are suffering. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that somehow that's going to address, psychedelics are going to address the average working person or poor person in Kentucky's woes, or for that matter, address an upper middle class person's woes. We have been, and there's I think a fetishization of trauma. And the thing about trauma is it becomes very localized and animized, right? Trauma becomes a sort of a nationalism, right? It's a way to join with others, but also isolate, that the historic pain, your historic pain sets you apart, and then the boundaries around you, you know, however big the boundary needs to go for that historic pain to be preserved, to be protected and not triggered, that's the boundaries justify that. And almost any action to not face that triggering is justified. And the problem, I think there's been so much good work around trauma, but like when something becomes a totality, there's, you know, I'm a fan of Ivan Illich, you know, when it becomes orthodox, it becomes the exact opposite of what it's gonna, when it becomes an institution, you know, and as a Christian, I know that all institutions are inherently demonic. So like it becomes this other thing. So what's being ignored in the trauma question is, you know, you're an analyst, right? You know, which old fashioned alienation, right? Alienation from one species essence. And that speaks to meaning. That speaks to purpose. And when you're in a space like Gabon, or I imagine someplace in the hills of Kentucky, where there is a continuum, or New Orleans or Greece, or, and there's a continuum, a cultural continuum, and a place within that world that one can find their meaning, then maybe you have less of that, because that alienation is less. But when you're in a modern world, one of the gifts of modernity is also the fearful thing about it is that you have to invent it. You have to invent the self. You have to invent your place. But when you're not given tools or spaces for that invention, then I think you get that alienation. So simply said, it's fucking terrible what we've produced. We are consumers. And we have very little connection like we used to have with one another. And the job of a man, for instance, the gender-defied job of a man has become smaller and smaller. And then you got these working class people who, and poor people who used to be able to make a decent living and they can't. And if they do make a living, and if they do make a good living, they have no family time. And so what I'm saying is that there's material conditions that create addiction, that create sadness, that create despair, that create a need to escape and a need to soothe. And I think that's what's happening. And increasingly we're animized. Increasingly we're othering ourselves and others. And yeah, I think that's what's up.
I track totally with that. Yes. I get pretty frustrated with, as a clinician, you know, when you really work with people and you start to think, where are they sick? And the culture wants to tell them it's their issue, and it's not most of the time. It's a family system that didn't know how to meet your needs. It's a culture that doesn't incentivize people to express genuine interiority and explore it in a meaningful way. You know, that it doesn't incentivize or set up conditions in which human beings can be healthy together in community in meaningful ways. You know, something, my one gripe, because I talk a lot about churches, and all due respect to everybody I know running a church, but a dear friend of mine who's also a priest, we were just talking about this and saying, you know, there's a lot of folks who aren't going into organized religious tradition that aren't, that then they're sacrificed because they don't get the communal experience because we don't have one story to convene around. And of course, then my cynic looks at certain sacred spaces and said, well, those are social spaces that you've learned the right dance steps and you know the right songs to, and you know when to sing those songs, and now you're a part of something. And I don't mean that to diminish that. I think that's a huge value, but I certainly resonate deeply with your critique of our culture. What stirred for you just then?
Yeah, man, I think what you're talking about is space, right? Again, that's exactly what you're talking about. And, you know, there's talk about access to psychedelics, but access to what, you know? And so how can we, and what was lacking in what you were just saying was playfulness, where someone feels safe enough to take some risks.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm wondering, you know, I also have to say that, like, I get really fed up with sort of the fetishizing of psychedelics and the specializing. I don't think, I hope that psychedelics didn't come about, the language didn't come about because of mushrooms. It's such a boring story. Or that, I don't think that the hand paintings on Lascaux walls had to be psychedelically induced. They feel very human. And so that what I'm saying is that if we could just create more spaces where people can become human and play in a very serious way and engage the imagination. And I think we have a bunch of great teachers that we can work with. We have all kinds of artists and organizers and doulas and ministers and people work with children. And I think that the further we get away from those types of organic expressions of creativity, the more endangered we become. So as we, you know, I always talk about the harm of reductionism. We somehow need the scientists. We need them, right? Reductionism is an incredible process, but what happens with that reduction, like it did in the 12-step space when they decided to call it a disease. I mean, it worked. I mean, it got people's attention. Happened in the harm reduction world when we said, hey, man, we're reducing HIV/AIDS. Well, that was true, but then it became just about that and not about, you know, closing down the drop-in center to do people's hair on a Wednesday afternoon. Mm. And then we're seeing that with psychedelics. Like, well, you have to legitimize this. We have to, you know, would you... And we'll just introduce it. We got the science, but the science doesn't tell the story. I always say that we need the precision of the inexactitude of poetry to tell the story. Mm-hmm. Because if we rely on the science, then it will become a scientific thing. And I have to say that the spaces that the scientists have created, I guess social scientists, you should open the door for them. But the hard side, right on. The hard scientists, I should have included them in my group of folks. There's a bunch of people I didn't include. You know, people cook good meals should be there. Anyway, carpenters, all kinds of people. But once we go into their spaces, those spaces tend to be very reductive. Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk to doulas, death mm-hmm. and birth doulas, because I want to know how they navigate. And I've heard a few, how they navigate the hospitals, how they navigate those systems. But I think we have to look outside of those structures. What I've been thinking about the last couple of years is looking at social medicine, the little I know about it, right? Mm-hmm. The idea that instead of fighting cholera, you know, like just giving people the treatment for cholera, you trace it back to the one pump in London that was where the cholera was coming from, and you close the pump down, right? And from that idea, sort of based on those same ideas, you have stuff like the settlement houses in the early part of the last century, where immigrants and migrants would come to a new city and they would find, you know, not only a doctor there, but also art and organizing, and the art and organizing and places to eat a meal or share recipes or childcare. And part of the organizing and part of the art and part of the childcare was trying to change the system, so the structures in which we live in, you know, to maybe organize a union in the case of that time. And so that sort of replicated in the 60s, early 60s, with people going, with Northerners going down south and folks down south, like sort of organizing around medicine, and then of course ACT UP and the harm reduction spaces. But I think if we could, what I like to say is, psychedelics have been de-queered, you know, and I mean that with a small Q. Like, if we could re-queer psychedelics, mm-hmm. so it does become a disruptive, creative agent, you know, and it's not by itself, it's simply not. I mean, if we think about the history of how the first sort of crackers ever to do psychedelics, it was, well, fucking the richest people in the late 50s, and they ran the CIA and the Luces and Time Magazine and Chase Bank, and what did they do with their psychedelic experience? They went on and created neoliberalism and the Cold War, right? So the idea is that we need to go in with the intention that maybe we're at the point where we can make change. And I see that with younger people. I see it with, you know, regardless of whatever work they're doing or not doing, the organizations like Extinction Rebellion, which is an organization around climate change and doing direct action, that came out of an Iboga trip. You know, that's the type of thing we need to see, is like the actual action. You know, God bless you for going to once a month or every other week to your ayahuasca circle. And we do call it work, but you know, you could pray your ass off for that work and the Amazon's still burning. Let's see if we can actualize some of the stuff that we've learned and to actually care for others. And maybe not by serving them ayahuasca, probably not, you know, maybe just serving them a meal. a decent meal, and bringing food to people, or bringing water to people, or more humane treatment to animals, or peace, by the way, seems like the psychedelics have not only been commodified and medicalized, but it's been militarized. Big article in The Intercept about a dear friend of mine who I mentioned earlier, trying to bring Iboga to soldiers in Ukraine so they can fight better. And the same guy that was a yippie, how about we give him Iboga so we don't fight and we change the structures that can create those wars? And how about we maybe use MDMA as before folks go to battle, so we can figure out strategies. Anyway,
I want to push a little bit. I'm aware of our time, so I want to be mindful of something. But something important about this piece that there, I do think that religions have historically occupied a space to create ecstatic experience. And in the Greek, like using the Greek ecstasis to get outside of yourself. And so at minimum, I do think one way, and I'll see what you think, we can talk about this, is that there's a glimpse, there's like a meta conscious experience of your, of consciousness outside of yourself. And just that experiential reality, having gone through that process and then having the question, what is perception? What are my assumptions about the nature of reality that have now phenomenologically and experientially have been disrupted? And to your point, now how can I take that and not just get involved in my own self-serving endeavors, my own routines and collectively probably gifted behaviors? Now I can do something different in the kind of social body and naturally. When you said earlier about psychedelics, I love Salvador Dali's quote, Dali doesn't need drugs, Dali is drugs. You know, like we're the pharmacopoeia. We are the pharmacy. And we've forgotten that we can have these, whether it's sexual or experiential or bonding, playfulness, you know, like taking risk in healthy ways, you know, all these ways we can stimulate and generate life from within that we may not have to then continue to go to substance outside of sacred space.
Yeah, I think you're hitting on something so important, because what is done with the ecstatic experience in the ecstatic church, for instance, or any sort of esoteric Kabbalah or Sufism or even within the mainstream religions, what's done with the ecstatic experience is really important. And so all these systems, including the indigenous practices, have a structure that not only allows for that, but also controls it.
Channels it, yeah.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, it channels it, and that could go any way.
Yeah.
So I think what you're hitting on is exactly it. What I'm referring to is like we create the sacredness in that set apart. I'm a ceremonialist, and I have some friends who say, what the fuck is a ceremony? Well, it's a beginning, a middle, and an end, right? And it's a container in which to hold it. But I try not to base it. I mean, I'm talking to my own sky god the whole time. But I try not to name the name unless I know there's other the people in it are have that same name, and I wouldn't even name it because maybe they're finding a different name, right? You know, so my job is to be non-formulaic as possible, but like the only time we formulate is to sort of to hold the safe the boundaries of safety. The biggest one is self-love and self-forgiveness, right? But anyway. But what do we do with that after? And what do we do with that experience? You know, oneness, as my partner Ross, my business partner Ross Ellenhorn likes to say, there is an experience of oneness, and that's called authoritarianism, right? So that's one experience of oneness. And you can look at religions that are based on oneness and look at the cultures in which they come from. It can be pretty authoritarian. And the other bit of oneness is love is an essential component. My sister said to me the other day that it's got to be love and empathy And then last night I was at an incredible musical event. Anyways, and I was talking with friends afterwards. And love, empathy, and discernment. Discernment needs to be in there. And maybe we could help folks with the discernment, right? Maybe the sacred space can be a space where we can experience each other and then support each other going out into the world, right? As does happen in mosques and churches and synagogues and temples, right? It does happen. But maybe we can take the message out into the world in direct service. And sometimes that service will not only be service, but it will be disruption, which I think we're really at the point of
I hope
disruption.
so. So, given that we've got to finish in a bit, I want to, two things. I want to give you plenty of time to really talk about what Kardea is all about, because given your history, for you then to be throwing your hat in the ring of creating a structure and how you're navigating that, but also just letting people know what that is, and any PSA that you have for people who are guiding or people who are needing this kind of treatment, who may be opioid dependent, any kind of thing you want to send us off with, so that can be our way we spend the next 9 minutes.
Right. I should say that I haven't worked in opioid detox in a number of years. I left because of all the things we talked about. I thought that we were shaming folks and we were setting them up for failure. And I've been working in harm reduction space for 20 years, and I've also been working with mushrooms and MDMA and recently ketamine. So Kardea is a space I co-founded with Ross Ellenhorn and the musician Juan McLean. I'd say it's more of an art space than a clinic. We have a ketamine center in New York. It's designed by Randy Palumbo. You should go and check out Randy's work or check out Kardea.net. We do ketamine sessions here. We do them with this ethos of radical hospitality and holding. We center art, we center playfulness, but we center holding. That's our main thing, is that we are here to explore that and discover what that means to you. So there's live sound that we create. I just played for a brother for right before we got on here. And so we're very excited about that. We also have a retreats in Jamaica with mushrooms. And we're soon to be in Nocera, Costa Rica. It's the same ethos of sound, art, music. Ross Ellenhorn, I encourage you to look into Ross's work on play and change.
He'll be
And
on
I'll.
in probably the episode after you. Ross will be
Oh,
on.
right on, right on, right on. And then look up Juan McLean's work as well. And we at this space, we have a, it's a very unique, beautiful space. We also do events that might be psychedelic adjacent, may not. We've had the trans choir here doing beautiful choir work. We've had conversations on Foucault and acid, the history of laughing gas. We also work monthly out of a nightclub in New York, where we do a presentation at Nowadays Nightclub. So the idea is this is a community space, and that we're open for community. The other thing we're excited about is we work with the nonprofit wing, the Further Fund, spelled like the bus. And the Further Fund is to provide access to folks who wouldn't have access, but not just access to the drugs, because we're really concerned actually that people are going to have access to these drugs, and given in the way they've given every other goddamn drug, right? And so we want people to have access to this type of way of holding. So the Further Fund, it's a nonprofit that provides, at this point, we're working with the people who are holding space for others. We started our first initiative, and we're well into it. We're working with people who work in the harm reduction space, people who do overdose reversals, who work in homeless shelters, who work in drop-in centers, who work for the state or the city or not NGOs. So people who have experienced a lot of burnout, a lot of sadness and trauma around the deaths of their clients and seeing people coming in and out of jail. So we want this space to be able to hold them so they can renew and then and perhaps change the way they do it. We're also providing training for those folks. This is our first group of people. We're opening that up to anyone who works in a governmental or nonprofit space. So first responders, of course, but also social workers, psychiatric nurses. We have a bunch of psychiatric nurses. We have some people who work with Department of Social Services around, battered kids, climate change activists. I'm missing stuff. We want to work with the people in sanitation. God bless them. Mm-hmm. I mean, what a job, man. We want to support them. And then we also want to identify those people from those communities that we're doing this and train them in our methods.
Man, that sounds like a hugely impactful endeavor. That's great.
Well, yeah, dude, we've done it. We're already a cohort of 45, but by the end of this year, hopefully we want to say that we've worked with hundreds. So that's the Further Fund. Mm-hmm. You can find that at Cardea.net, Further Fund. And then, if you qualify for that in the New York City area, please reach out to us. These are the helping professionals, the people who make change in the world. And then we're also beginning our work with On Point in Harlem, which is the place that I worked at, the harm reduction space on 126th Street, which you might know about because they have the first OCP, the first safe injection place, but it's a wraparound service, incredible organization. I co-created along with Brian Murthy and Juan Cortez and some older members of the Young Lords Party, a holistic center there, which offered holistic, sound, meditation, ceremony, acupuncture for very poor people. And that's where I worked for 10 years. So we are slowly making our way to having a ketamine space there. And we've just started some conversations with an organization called Action Lab. Again, an organization that supports the change makers. We need to make this social medicine. Cardea, if you are in the New York City area, it's not a medicalized approach. We do work with doctors, but the idea is that we want to engage you and hold you to maybe have a relationship with your suffering, a relationship with your PTSD or whatever the diagnosis is, and not become that. So for folks that come into Cardea, we offer group stuff, which is live sound, like incredibly skilled artists playing live music for you.
Yeah.
We also offer in-house music here. It's an incredible space. So there's a couple of price tiers there as well, because we want to make it accessible. Yeah. And so that's what we're doing. It's been kind of bizarre for me to try to become petty bourgeois at the ripe old age of 61. But giving it a shot.
Give it a shot, man. Look, we got to finish, and it's a total joy. And I look forward to more conversations. There are so many threads connect. I mean, even this last one, what we're building down here, it's very resonant with the kind of ethos that we're talking about in a larger community. So keep going, man. Keep doing. I'm ready to learn and communicate and work together and bump up against each other. And what a great experience it is to know you and to get to know you in the future.
Yeah, John, I'm looking in your face, man, and you're my friend. I can feel it. Yeah. And God bless you. And, anyone who's listening, if they're suffering, there's all kinds of way out. You're a psychedelic being. You don't need to take the medicine, but if you want to, that's okay too, man. But God bless you all. Take care, man.
Amen.